The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gift. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to this special series on Third World Nationalism on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Megu. I also host my own podcasts, Independent Thought and Freedom, and also a story club, Global Politics and Global Cultures. In the wake of a rise in nationalism around the world and its general condemnation by liberals and the left, in addition to the rise of China and Russia, we have put together this series on third world nationalism to nuance the present discourse on nationalism, to note its centrality to anti-imperial, anti-colonial politics around the world, the reconfiguration of global power, and its inextricability from mainstream politics in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Today, my guest is James Siegmeier, author of Latin American Nationalism, Identity in a Globalizing World, published by Bloomsbury Academic in 2017. Welcome, James.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm joining you from Trinidad and Tobago here in the Caribbean, sometimes considered part of Latin America, sometimes not.
Yes.
And how about yourself? Where are you joining us from?
I'm in Morgantown, West Virginia, in the Chili Mountains of the northern part of the United States.
Okay. Nice, nice. Well, we like to start off our interviews normally by asking our guests to give a little bit of background about themselves and what got you interested in your subject, in this case, Latin American nationalism.
Well, I entered graduate school about 35 years ago, a long time ago, and I was interested in U.S. Latin American relations, especially during the Cold War. And I was focusing in the 1950s, and most of the interpretations at that time said the United States was obsessively concerned with suppressing communism during the Cold War, and especially in the 1950s. And my attitude was, well, yeah, certainly that's true, but we need to dig a little bit deeper. We need to look at I think, a more profound factors, more profound changes going on in Latin America in the 1940s and 1950s. And I hinged upon the idea of economic nationalism, that the United States was certainly afraid of communism, but they were actually more afraid of this deeper movement, more long term, you know, going back to the very beginning of the Latin American national period of the 19th century, in which the Latin American nations wanted to diversify their economies. They wanted to industrialize. And they wanted to be not totally self-sufficient, but less subject to the vagaries of international markets. So most Latin American countries at that time, and still today, are dependent on exporting primary products, whether they're valuable metals, agricultural products. Certainly, industrialization has occurred in the last, you know, two or three decades at a rapid rate. But many countries are still dependent economies, and they wanted to become less dependent. The United States, however, had a different vision, and I would argue still has a different vision. In the United States, most of the political leadership, maybe not 100%, but most of it is very focused on the idea of free markets and open trading zones. That will, if you open up borders to trade investment, private sector trade investment, wherever it comes from, it doesn't matter. That's going to jumpstart the economies of Latin America and the Third World. And this sort of free economic trade zone is a very deeply held vision on the part of the United States. And U.S. officials didn't take too kindly to the fact that Latin Americans wanted to, shall we say, control part of their economic destiny, not the whole thing. The economic nationalists wanted to control certain key sectors, dynamic sectors of the economy, and they wanted to, like I said, promote policies to diversify their economies and industrialize. And therein lies the rub. There was the conflict that I saw in the 1950s, but I think we could carry that argument up, you know, to the 60s, the 70s, and even beyond.
Oh, that's interesting. And you said 35 years ago, so that
mid-80s, right, yes.
So that would be like when Central America, so you it would be like the tail end of the Sandinistas, FMLN would have been in El Salvador.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Dr. Mangu, because that is another reason I got interested in this field. I entered graduate school just at the time the Iran-Contra scandal was breaking. It's, if you remember, the Reagan administration was illegally selling weapons to terrorists supporting Iran, a country the United States didn't have diplomatic relations with and had very, very contentious relations with, in order to provoke or encourage Iran to use its influence with Hezbollah and other radical groups in the Middle East to free American and British hostages. And this was driven by domestic politics. The Reagan administration wanted the hostages to be freed and walk down those planes triumphantly in United States soil just before the 1986 midterm elections. And indeed, some of the hostages were freed, but then, of course, the scandal broke. And I became fascinated in U.S. Latin American relations around that time, although my interest shifted away from Central America, more to South America, not for any other reason that I simply found South America more in line with my own personal interest than Central America. But Central America and U.S., the U.S. inspired or caused crisis in Central America in the 1980s definitely was something that got me into what I'm doing today.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm probably just a little bit younger than you. I was born in 68. But I was profoundly influenced by that. And I was in a program called International Development Studies at the University of Toronto.
Yeah.
And we had a placement for 1 year in a third world country. And my aim was to get to El Salvador. And
interesting. And there's another bit of overlap there, too, is that I was very interested in economic development as well. Mm-hmm. Basically, 35 years ago, when I was making the decision to go to graduate school, I had to decide, of course, where I'm going to go to graduate school. And I was sort of on the fence between doing development studies or doing development economics or going into history and looking at the history of economic development. And I decided on the latter for a number of reasons. So
Right. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah. And, I think it's actually one of the purposes behind that inspired me and the New Books Network to put together this series, because I think that a lot of developments in the world, especially the rise of China,
right,
can only be understood within this discourse of, you know, where, you know, at that time it would be like the new international economic order and UNIDO and changing the IMF and the P5 and changing the whole sort of, you know, imperial structure of international politics, financial agency. But that seems to be totally missing from the discourse on what's happening in the world. And I think, you know, and especially as you say, and as you point out in your book, the, you know, your focus on economic nationalism, that is actually one of the distinctive things about Latin American nationalism, different from African and Asian. Right. Can you expand on that?
I mean, I think the main difference, or sort of deeply historical difference, I think you could say, is that in Latin America, political independence came in the early 19th century, whereas political independence in Asia and in Africa, not for all of the countries, but for nearly all of them, came in the mid 20th century. So in Latin America, there was a large gap between at least nominal political independence and economic and social development. Whereas the other parts of the third world, Asia and Africa, political independence, economic independence, social development were all kind of projects that were happening at the same time. So they were all intertwined and mixed together. And some would say much more complicated, much more interesting, and much more hard to understand. Whereas in Latin America, the trajectories are different. Political first, and then economic and social later, which I personally found to be quite interesting, because how do you explain that gap? And then how do you explain the sort of burst of interest in economic and social nationalism, you might say, in the mid-20th century?
Yeah, I want to explore that a little more. But let me ask you then, your subtitle of the book is Identity in a Globalizing World, which is kind of, you know, it's not politics, it's not economics. Right. So that's interesting. Right. Why did you take that angle?
Right. Well, I guess you could say in some ways it was just in the air or in the discourse. You know, there's identity studies have been a really important part of the field of history, you know, going back to the 1970s, 1980s. I think the identity studies have been focused very much on Europe and the United States and the global north, you might say, whereas there's been less attention. Some scholars, of course, have looked at identity formation or identity in the developing world, of course. But in the United States and in Europe and the global north, you might say, there's been less interest in that. However, another thing that's going on is that, you know, I wanted to look at globalization and nationalism. I mean, wanted to look at the intersection of those two major forces in the world today. And then, you know, what's the bridge? You know, what's the connection? And there's a number of ways you can do it. But I found identity to be sort of the most easy to get my head around, the easiest to sort of use as an analytic category, you might say. Because with globalization and nationalism, you have, in a sense, layers of identity. In fact, if I had could do it over again, I might actually change the subtitle to sort of layers of identity in a globalizing world, because you have national identity, you have global identities, and you also have a local, you know, a region-based identities, racial identities, gender identities. And so I found identity to be, for lack of a better word, sort of a useful tool of understanding the intersection of nationalism and globalization.
All right. Well, I mean, it's something you explore throughout your book.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, it might be difficult to just to encapsulate it in a little soundbite. But, you know, if you were to just briefly discuss, you know, so what is the relationship between globalization and nationalism in Latin America?
Well, I mean, it comes down to basically, you know, so national identity experienced a burst of interest in the 19th century, right after the countries in Latin America broke away from Portugal and from Spain and other countries. Certainly, globalization was a factor then because Latin America emerged, and the globalization goes back to the 14th to 15th century. But then, with the national identity, once it gets formed, pretty solidly by the early 20th century, then globalization takes off in a much more forceful way, you might say. And so then the Latin Americans have to sort of merge the national identity and the global identity. And of course, it depends a lot on, you know, whether you're living in a port city or near a coast where you're subject to more global influences, or whether if you're in a smaller country, which is very dependent on the export of one product, you know, Bolivia for metals, for example, or islands in the Caribbean for with regard to sugar, for example, then a globalization is going to have a much bigger impact on, you know, your reality and even your identity.
Right. And another thing is that you did sort of allude to it earlier just now, but you speak about, you know, that there are many nationalisms in Latin America.
Yeah.
Political elites of indigenous peoples, of the urban, middle and working classes. And that's a very important point to make. Can you elaborate a bit on it?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the starting point is what I call a top-down nationalism. I have not found too many authors that have used that, but I think that's a starting point for nearly all Latin American countries, because the Latin American elites in the early 19th century, which led the effort to break away from the imperial nations of Spain and Portugal, realized quickly that they felt they needed to impose their idea of European nationalism on, you know, as many quarters of their countries as they could, to create a sort of national unity on their terms. But then, almost as quickly as this top-down nationalism was imposed, or as the process unfolded, you have resistance based on localities or regions of the individual countries. You have resistance based on racial or ethnic categories, indigenous nationalism or Afro-Latin American nationalism. And then when you get up to the 20th century with urbanization, you have what you might call another twist on nationalism, which is populism, especially of in Argentina and Chile, in Bolivia, and many parts of Central America. This populism is of the urban, working, and middle classes, basically saying, you know, to the elites who largely control the political system up to World War II, you know, no longer are you sort of you know, land-based oligarchs, you know, going to call the shots for, you know, for urban Latin America. Urban Latin Americans need better roads, better schools, more sort of economic development, urban economic development, basic public services, and also from the point of view of the indigenous people and Afro-Latin Americans, basic civil and human rights. And so this populism in the mid-20th century, I would argue, is a continuation of nationalism, but with a different twist.
Right. And it's very interesting with the kind of nationalism in Europe and North America today. Well, the United States in particular, not really Canada. But in terms of the populist revolt is kind of middle and working class. But not against the landed aristocracy. Yeah. It's similar in some ways and very different in other ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, no, that's one thing. If I could write another edition of my book, I think I would emphasize more clearly the differences between nationalism in Latin America versus Europe and the United States today, where, of course, it is blossoming. But it seems like in Europe and the United States, to me, nearly all nationalists are on the right politically. Not all, but it's nationalism in Europe, the United, and North America, maybe not Canada, but the United States, is a conservative nationalism. Whereas in Latin America, you have both what I call left-wing nationalism, which I focus on in my book, but there is a conservative nationalism as well. I think left-wing nationalism in Latin America is especially concerned with outside forces, you know, powerful countries trying to impose neo-colonial control, you know, or ownership of key sectors of the economy, right? But conservative nationalism in Latin America is very prominent, especially once you get to the 1960s and 1970s, in which there's a fear of many Latin Americans of all social classes, but more middle and upper class, that, you know, left-wing nationalism has gone too far. You know, it's too radical, and it's being supported by communism, right?
Yeah.
And so conservative nationalism, you know, really comes to the fore in in Latin America in the 1960s to 1970s. But I wish I'd emphasize a little bit more in my book that the nationalism in Latin America, perhaps because Latin America is such a complex area racially, geographically, in terms of the backgrounds of immigrants, left-wing and right-wing nationalism are kind of fighting it out. Whereas nationalism in the United States and Europe seems to go from a period of dormancy and then becomes conservative once you have an immigrant crisis, which happens in the 21st century. And then perhaps it will diminish down, later on, become dormant again, and then it will pop up again.
Right, right. I've been really fascinated by Latin American nationalism in a number of ways. Being in the Caribbean, we're so close, but we're in the English-speaking Caribbean, so we're so distant as well. Because although Venezuela is like 7 miles away, we can see it from the tip.
Right,
New York is closer. Yeah, so it's like another world because it's Spanish speaking, and we were, British colonies, and there was this kind of saying that we used to have in the early 20th century before we became independent, when people used to act very anarchically, and they'd say, what do you think this is, a republic? Meaning the Bolivarian Republic, Venezuela. And even when we became independent in the mid-60s, just like Africa, the British and French Empire decolonization as opposed to the Spanish Empire, mid 20th century. So, and our populations are African and in Trinidad, Guyana, and Suriname, Indian as well. So we have a lot of those connections. But then again, because we're in Latin America, in the shadow of the United States, and we're covered by UN ECLAC and stuff like that, and so we have this strong economic nationalism discourse, which I am a part of, in intellectual and political organizations and whatnot, a long history of that. So it's kind of like between, and it's always so fascinating to me. That Latin American nationalism was really part of the same kind of Enlightenment European nationalism
in
the 18th century. But as you say, it's kind of excluded and marginalized and not really looked at. Like if you think of Benedict Anderson, he had a little section in a chapter somewhere, not a couple of paragraphs on Creole nationalism, but he basically ignores it.
Right.
And then later a subaltern and post-colonial studies, as you say, it's excluded. Then in the 90s, when Eastern European nationalism and post-communist, again, the Latin American nationalism is excluded. Yeah. So I'd like you to share your reflections on that distinctiveness, yet, exclusion. And we don't really, the rest of the world doesn't really take it seriously or look at it deeply enough.
Right. Yeah. No, I think you put it very well and very, very succinctly and very clearly about, the trends of nationalism in the third world and the subaltern studies boom of the post-Cold War world. And Latin American nationalism was sort of dormant or ignored. And I remember when I was in graduate school in my early years as an academic, I was talking about this and a lot of people were wondering what I was talking about and why should they care about it? But I think what really changed the game for Latin American nationalism or Latin American nationalists was what a lot of observers call the pink tide of the 21st century in South America in particular, but in other parts of Latin America, the Caribbean as well. And this is largely a response to neoliberalism. So starting in the 1980s, the sort of U.S. and European global north vision for the third world of, open economies, free trade and investment was agreed to by many of the subaltern nations, not all, but many of them. And this provoked a reaction. And I think the left-wing reaction was helped along by the fact that communism had fallen. And so the left in Latin America was no longer tainted, as is the case around the world, no longer tainted with sort of the Stalinist Soviet brush, you might say. They could say, we're socialists, we're leftists, we're not communists. We don't believe in the sort of communist view of history and the communist world domination. We believe in a better life for the working classes, the poor of our country. And this really took off in the early 21st century with nearly every South American nation being left or center left, and many in Central America and the Caribbean as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, for lack of a better word, that sort of forced the world to recognize that Latin American nationalism was real. The Latin American nationalists were standing up and speaking very clearly, such as Chavez in Venezuela, Correa in Ecuador, and Morales in Bolivia. But there's others as well, Lula in Brazil, and you know, you could name Kirchner in Argentina, and you know, many around the hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you say that there is a kind of story of Latin American nationalism? You've kind of alluded to it, where you know, you have the political first, and then sort of the economic, and you know, and Latin America really did lead, I think, a lot in both fields. If you really think about it,
So I think that I don't want it to be sort of too lockstep a narrative, but I think that you've got the first two parts. I mean, certainly political and then economic, and then later on, sort of social and cultural. And I think once you get into the 21st century, cultural nationalism, even though it's been there all along, becomes more prominent. And part of this is because of instant communications with the internet and satellite technology. People can see, you know, the wonder of Latin American soccer all around the world. Latin American foods becoming popular all around the world. Latin American music, you know, Shakira in Colombia, but there's a ton of other ones, becomes popular all around the world. And so I think that cultural nationalism and globalization, that intersection is perhaps the easiest to understand of all the different sort of connections you can make between nationalism and globalization. Take nationalism plus instant communications and sort of ease of access to the internet and satellite television, and you have a sort of globalized Latin American culture.
Yeah, I'd like you to elaborate a bit on what you, the kind of question that you said you thought about yourself, about the kind of, I don't know if we want to call it a delay period or between the political and the economic, you know, because you had, you know, Simon Bolivar and the Haitian Revolution, very, very important things. And I myself, I'm very hazy on the Spanish decolonization. You know, I know you had because it was New Spain. Yeah. You know, you didn't have Venezuela and Uruguay and Paraguay, as far as I'm aware. Yeah. But they broke up into smaller Colombia and smaller parts in Central America. And so and I think, you know, Britain and perhaps the United States had some role to play. Right. I know the capture of Trinidad, I think, was related to that. So, yeah. So if you could, you know, I guess – describe a bit about that Spanish decolonization process and how it's, you know, different and may not quite be understood. And then that kind of, I guess, fallow period, if you want to put it that way. And what awoke the economic nationalism?
Yeah, no, I think this is a really important part of the story, which hasn't been told too many times, or at least that systematically in the existing literature. So when I had a chance to write this book, I felt privileged and lucky to be able to sort of explore these ideas, because I don't think too many people had really tried to look at it as a sort of kind of coherent whole. And my my work's sort of like a first step in that process. But I mean, the starting point is with the Spanish decolonization in Latin America. It was incredibly chaotic and violent. Compared to revolutions in many other parts of the country, of the world. Now, obviously, the French Revolution, Russian Revolution are very bloody, and Chinese as well. But in Latin America, because of the geography, because of the diversity of the peoples, because of how long the Wars for Revolution took, and then after the Wars for Revolution settled, as it were, Bolivar tried his sort of confederation of Gran Colombia and the northern tier of South America. That fall was falling apart before he died, and then fell apart. And also, I think, as you alluded to in the latter part of your question, it's really important to keep in mind that as you know, the political situation sort of finally sorts itself out in the late 19th century, you have British and American, you might call neocolonialism or free trade imperialism, in which the Latin American countries realize that they can make a lot of money quickly by selling products to the Europeans and the United States. And so many Latin American countries become sort of neo-colonies, so politically independent, but economically dependent. And then once Britain, with World War II, begins to sort of run out of steam, you might say, run out of economic power, the United States becomes the more dominant power. The Latin Americans, I don't want to say realize, but sort of come to the realization, you might say, is that if we want to have economic development, we have to have economic nationalism. And the United Nations is going to be part of this as well with ECLA, Economic Commission Latin America. You know, how can we have better terms of trade for our primary source exporting countries? How can we take our, you know, wealth of primary sources, where primary resources, primary product resources, you know, minerals and agricultural products, and then use that, the proceeds from that, to industrialize and become more economically developed. So I think that neo-colonial period in which the United States, you know, sort of burst on the world scene in the late 19th, early 20th century, the Spanish-American War, but probably even more importantly, sort of, you know, U.S. economic power and U.S. military occupations of many Caribbean countries, such as Haiti, Dominican Republic, there's invasions of Cuba after the Spanish-American War, and then also, you know, use of troops in Mexico and Honduras. And so the United States becomes, you could say from the point of view of Latin American nationalists, a political threat and an economic threat in the early 20th century.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really important, I think, to elaborate on the sort of Latin American development of certain concepts that are central to development theory.
Yeah.
I mean, we in the Caribbean, like, you know, we've had Arthur Lewis and then
Lloyd
Price, who developed plantation theory, which is very, very similar because I think the objective conditions were very similar.
Right.
So we were coming to similar conclusions. But, but you know, the dependency theory, you know, Wallerstein stuff.
Yes,
you know, and then the linking of like IMF, MNCs, CIA, right? All this stuff.
Right, yes, exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean? it's like, well, one is economic, one is, you know, political.
Right.
And the neo-colonialism and then the communism, the left wing, the populism, the indigenism, the right wing authoritarian, the juntas. It's this very interesting kind of story, you know, in terms of it's grappling both politically and intellectually, policy-wise, with questions of development, and it becomes very tied in to nationalism. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, I think that you put it very well, talking about how, you know, sort of economic nationalism in the early 20th century, early to mid 20th century, becomes fused with the political nationalism, with the U.S., you know, overt military occupations of many Caribbean and some Central American countries, but then also with the CIA and covert action. And so I think Latin Americans realize by, you know, the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, that the United States presents a sort of multi-pronged power. it's economic and political. And so the main tool the Latin Americans have, which is an obvious one because of their tradition, is nationalism. And so I think nationalism takes its a left-wing turn in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s for the reasons that you just laid out.
And then you talk about the nationalism and populism, of course, is very much tied to you mentioned, you know, Argentina and there's Peronism, right? Yeah. Now people, you know, many people would know it just because of the musical Evita, but they might not really quite understand, you know, what Peronism is, because it was kind of enigmatic. It doesn't fit into the European left-right spectrum. You know, so could you sort of explain that phenomenon for people?
Yeah, no, I think the basis is, or the best way to understand it is really the changeover, the transition of Latin America as an agricultural country where the largest landowners would own, you know, thousands of hectares of land simply for reasons of political power and status, and it allowed them to control most countries until World War II. But the cities were growing rapidly. World War II is an important part of the story, as Latin America exported a lot of oil and foodstuffs to the Allied nations to help them win World War II. With this process came urbanization. With urbanization, you have workers' movements. You have what we would call reform movements in the United States for better public services and more sort of middle class inspired reforms. How can we have better public education, better infrastructure, basic things such as infrastructure? And so populism kind of, the populace realized that there was a huge demand for, you know, sort of basic services and deepening the industrialization, using economic nationalism to develop key sectors of the economy, whether it's transportation or banking or whatever. And so I think that it was sort of like that delay we talked about with Latin American political independence in the early 19th century, but economic independence in the late 20th century. I think that there was such a demand for, you know, urban services and more political power for the urban working and middle classes that the populace sort of quickly filled the bill. They quickly realized that and they said, well, we can offer this to you. And there was sort of so much pent up demand for this type of leadership, I think you could say, that the populism was very powerful in the 1940s and 1950s. One thing I'd like to add too about the populism is that one reason it was so misunderstood by many people outside of Latin America, outside of South America, outside of the populist countries, is that is it communist or is it fascist? The First World wanted to put it into its own categories. And the Latin Americans are basically, no, we have our own categories for this. Certainly populists appeal to the working class, but they also appeal to the middle class, and also spoke in very nationalistic terms about sort of national power. You know, Proen's a great example of this, but the many all over Latin America, you know, use the nationalist narrative and nationalist vocabulary to say, you know, the true nationalism or the way to really build national power is through our populist policies. And the populists were, for the most part, democratic, but not always. I mean, they sometimes tended towards authoritarianism, but Perón was elected, and many populists, of course, were elected in other parts of Latin America at that time. So
yeah, there's the phenomenon called caudillismo, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, would you classify Perón in that sort of?
I would. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess I see caudillism certainly is not. A part of the Latin American experience. It happens all over the world. Mm-hmm. Charismatic, powerful leader, but in Latin America, it's especially powerful because of that 19th century experience where the revolutions against Spain and Portugal were so chaotic, especially against Spain, that caudillos rose with the basic sort of promise of even a small village or a large city or a large region, I will promise you security in exchange for loyalty. Don't ask any questions about democracy or corruption or whatever else is going on with me. That's not important. What's most important is I could offer you security in exchange for your loyalty.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Hobbesian Leviathan period.
Exactly. Kind of exactly. Yeah. And so I think that never really goes away. I mean, there's periods in Latin American history where a caudillo, especially World War II, where there's a lot of dislocation, economic dislocation. There's no physical destruction like you have in Europe or Asia, but you have economic dislocation, and you have controversies over, fascist groups in especially the Southern Cone countries. So a caudillo is someone who basically sort of rides it on his white horse and says, well, I can give you order and stability again. No more of this sort of instability or concern with fascism, concern with communism. Let's just be sort of populistic and nationalistic.
Yeah. You spend about, I think, is it three chapters in your book speaking about neoliberalism,
right,
which is very important.
Yeah.
And I mean, and one thing that you raise in your book, which I think is important in general, which is, for instance, even with nationalism, it's not or even globalization, it's not merely passively received by Latin America. They're active agents, certainly with neoliberalism, with Chile. And although the CIA and the Chicago Boys and all that stuff were involved, but it still was kind of, it did have a strong, national, local component.
Exactly.
And throughout Latin America, I mean, one of the distinctions that, that we like to make here from our school of thought in the from the plantation school of thought in the Caribbean about the difference between the Caribbean and Latin America generally is that in the Caribbean we were colonies of pure exploitation,
right? Exactly.
Whereas in Latin America they were colonies of conquest,
right?
And you know that sort of the that old conquistador class, right. That yeah. Spanish class, you know, is definitely tied in to, you know, neoliberalism becomes a kind of just the latest incarnation,
right. Exactly,
in some sort of ways. But yeah. If you could just elaborate on the phenomenon of neoliberalism in Latin America and this Latin American variant, because I myself am very interested the way the term has become so recently popular now,
right.
Even
right.
in the United States.
Right.
Whereas,
right.
You know, as you would know from the 1980s and 90s, I mean, we are talking about this in development studies all the time.
Right.
So, yeah. So I'd like to hear you speak about it.
Right. Well, I mean, basically, I wanted to make the book useful or approachable to people in lots of different disciplines. I'm an historian, so I could write about the history, you know, the old history forever. But I wanted it to be used in, you know, political science classes and Latin American studies classes, even economic students and anthropology students could maybe benefit from it. So neoliberalism, I found to be that kind of bridge between what I call the sort of top down exploitation, as you talked about, or conquistador societies and purely exploitative societies of the 19th century, export driven economies, I think is the term that I use, in the late 19th right. century. That sort of idea is basically resurrected in the post Cold War world in the form of neoliberalism. And one reason why it becomes so popular, why I spend so much time on it in my book, is that Latin America goes through its own crisis in the 1970s and 1980s. In the 1970s, there was the Arab dictatorships and the human rights abuses. 1980s, you have the debt crisis and economic crises throughout. You know, Latin Americans accumulate a lot of debt in the 1970s for a number of reasons. Interest rates shoot up worldwide in the early 1980s, and they can't pay can't maintain their debt. They can't pay interest on their debts. And so some of them come close to defaulting and the debts have to be rewritten or written off. And so neoliberalism is something that is turned to by many Latin Americans out of crisis, out of what else can we do? And the first world, of course, pushing it pretty strongly. And so it's easy for many Latin Americans to say, well, we're in a mess here and we don't really have a solution we can think of off the top of our heads. And so maybe we should try neoliberalism since our other policies have not worked out as well as we would have.
If you don't mind me interjecting here.
Sure, yeah.
You know, in the history, you know, when we're looking at the West today and their debt crises,
yeah.
and you see their solution is not austerity, it's QR,
exactly.
It's more money,
right,
more
right,
money.
Right, yeah, right.
Debt
yeah,
level
exactly.
that they never would have accepted in the 1980s. You know,
right.
They would have chastised Mexico
right.
or Argentina or Brazil,
right.
you know, for that. But now, since it happened to them, it's
right.
like, oh, well, we could print. Now there's modern monetary theory. You could print as
right.
much money as possible.
Right. Yeah, I remember reading about this actually in graduate school in the late 1980s when I was becoming interested in U.S. Latin American relations. And there was an article in the media that stated it bluntly by saying, you know, what would an IMF policy look like if it was imposed on the United States? It's very easy mm-hmm. for the IMF to impose it on less powerful countries, you know. If you implement an austerity program, you know, third world country, we will give you loans at a lower rate of interest. And then you can use that as a way of sort of digging yourself out of your economic difficulties. But if we were to impose an austerity plan on the United States in the 1980s, that's when the debt was ballooning under mm-hmm. under Reagan.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been higher taxes. It would have been cuts to benefits. It would have been cuts to defense, all of which would be anathema to virtually everyone in the United States. it's hypocrisy, definitely.
Sorry, I interrupted your story. You're talking about the you know, the neoliberal solution that was being offered and prescribed within Latin America. So yeah, if you just
right.
like Chile, you know, is seen as I guess it was the start starting point.
I think it was. Yeah. And I think what's interesting about neoliberalism, and it's important to understand from the beginning, is that it was something that was done in collaboration with some of the leadership in Latin America. There were many in Latin America who thought, for the reasons I mentioned before about the debt crisis and the economic problems of the 70s and the 80s, you know, we really have to come up with a whole new game plan here, something totally new. It wasn't new because it went back to the 19th century, you know, export-driven economies. But to many people in the 21st century, it was new.
Yeah.
And sort of what flowed out of that, and one reason why I spend so much time in the book talking about it, is that I think the issues of today in the 21st century in Latin America, the Caribbean, largely flow out of neoliberalism. Not 100%, but yeah, quite a number of them. The inequality or the perceived inequality, both within nations and between nations. You know, inequality is perhaps the most dominant issue in the world today, whether it's the first world or the third world. Mm-hmm. And so I think neoliberalism is kind of the starting point for that. And now you have leaders in Latin America on the left, but others as well, basically saying, okay, we have to temper neoliberalism. We have to restrain it. We have to restrict it. We have to channel it in a way that's beneficial to ourselves. We can't simply accept it, you know, lock, stock, and barrel as we did in the 1990s, because now we have inequality. And also, coming back to globalization, the Latin American economies have perceived to have been perhaps too open economically and culturally. One example I like to talk about, since I used to live in Bolivia and did a lot of my research there and have written on U.S. relations with Bolivia, is the example of fast food, which becomes popular in Latin America because everyone likes fried burgers and fried potatoes. Mm-hmm. McDonald's was kept out of Bolivia for years because they refused to use Bolivian potatoes, where, of course, any history student knows the potato was developed in the Andes in Bolivia and Peru. And so basically the Bolivian government said to McDonald's, you have to use Bolivian potatoes, otherwise we're not allowing you in. McDonald's didn't agree to that because of their own supply chain and their own feelings of power, you might say. And so they weren't allowed in. And then eventually they were allowed in, and then they left again because of it sort of represents a symbol of multinational power and also U.S. culture. So I think that I don't want to say extreme openness, but the very open nature of the Latin American economies, and also with cultural globalization happening very quickly in the 21st century, many Latin American nations are trying to put a damper on that, trying to limit the influence of outside forces on their economies and cultures.
Right. You know, up to this point, we've been speaking about Latin America as a unified whole without any contradictions or differences. And of course, we know that's not
right. Yeah.
You know, what would be, I'll tell you from my perspective as a non-specialist, right? But an observer, things like, Argentina, up to the 1920s being considered a developed country like Canada Australia. So that difference there. And you mentioned in the beginning of your book, Bolivia and that football match. So that the difference is, the Argentinian superiority complex.
Exactly.
And then like the whole Brazil, of course, being Portuguese. I remember speaking to a Brazilian ambassador here once, and he was pointing out, there are more people that speak Portuguese in South America than Spanish,
Right, yeah, which is true. Yeah, it's exactly.
and then all the interesting history of Brazil in terms of like it was an empire, they had an emperor for a while and stuff. That's very interesting. Then you have like the contradictions of like Guyana and Suriname being kind of Caribbean culturally, but geographically in South America. Then you have your wars between different countries, I guess border wars. I'm not even very clear on a lot of those stuff. I just know they exist and they happen. Right. And then you have some of the later stuff, which kind of overturns sort of national boundaries, like migration, and then drugs and organized crime. So all these things I know complicate the issue. I'd like to know, you as a specialist, which do you think are some of the most important and interesting you know, complications to note, so, you know, in terms of, complication or contradictions in understanding the complexity of Latin America.
Right. Well, one I'd like to return to that you mentioned yourself, which I think is a very good way of looking at it, is that some countries, especially in the Caribbean, but you could probably find examples in mainland Latin America as well, were in the colonial period were pure exploitation, and you know the Haitian mm-hmm. Revolution of 1803 is one response to that, whereas the economies of the larger Latin American countries were more economies of, or it's more of a situation of conquest, as you say. Mm-hmm. And there was more economic development that happened indigenously and perhaps was spurred on by outside capital, like, you know, the British investment in railroads in Argentina and, mm-hmm. and lots of other economic endeavors. So I think that those two historical trajectories are very different. And I think that's one reason why neoliberalism becomes quite popular in South America, Mexico, and Central America in the 1980s, 1990s, and even beyond. Whereas I think in the Caribbean, because of that history of exploitation, of pure exploitation, as you put it, neoliberalism, once the neoliberalism idea was created in the late 20th century, I think many people in the Caribbean did not accept it or backed away from it or saw it for what it was. This is just a return to the pure exploitation. We'll have none of it.
Just to clarify, the pure exploitation, what is meant by that is that the owners of capital didn't even live in the place.
Exactly. Right?
It was just overseas investors.
Right.
So they didn't care. They didn't build universities or schools like they might have done in Mexico or Brazil or Argentina or even the American colonies.
But there are some countries in South America or Latin America that might fit that model. For example, in Bolivia, one reason for the Bolivian Revolution of 1952 was that the owners of capital, as you say, lived in Europe and the United States. And the people that were running them were just beholden to the outside capitalist powers, as it were. And I think you could say the same thing about Guyana, too, you had with the aluminum mines, with the bauxite mines, and also with a lot of the other economic endeavors there.
Well, we consider Guyana Caribbean. Yeah,
part of the Caribbean, right? Yes, exactly. That's true. Yes, anyway, I think your point is a really good one. Mm-hmm. One thing I would like to, maybe this is going a bit tangential, is that when you write a book, you want to have like a coherent narrative, especially if it's a student-oriented book. I don't want to call it a textbook because it's not comprehensive, but it's a student-oriented book, right? There's study questions at the end and lists of readings to help the students. And I wanted a book that could be used in Latin American studies and political science and history. So I think at the end of the book, if I was to do a second edition, I would talk more about something that you mentioned previously, and that's the incredible growth of China. And China's importance, or I should say Asia's importance in Latin America. I mean, there's large Asian populations going back to the 19th century, especially in the west coast of Central America and South America. But more apropos to what's going on today, Chinese investment, Japanese investment is increased dramatically in the last few years. And focusing on China for a minute, there's this, different type of economic development, modernization or modernization inspired economic development. I mean, it's communist, it's largely state run. It's not, certainly no believers they in the magic of the private sector to sort of unleash, human economic endeavor, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that, in my book, I mentioned China maybe at the end, but I think that, now, or even going back to the late 20th century, the Latin Americans have two different narratives. They have the sort of Western economic development, which, we all learn about in school. but I tell the students when I'm teaching, U.S. foreign relations, when I was your age, China was an underdeveloped country. And they can't believe it, right? It's like, it really
because
was.
They eat your food or else, children are starving in China.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So and for China to develop as it has so quickly has really blown the minds of many people in the Western world. And of course, the Latin Americans have picked up on this. And so they, in some ways, are perhaps using the Chinese model and the Western model, both. They're sort of mixing and matching. They're kind of, you know, yeah. Especially with the financial crisis in the Western world, largely in the Western world, 2008 through 2010, a number of developing world countries or non-industrialized countries were looking at the Chinese model simply for the reason, well, they didn't experience that crash. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have some better answers than the sort of, you know, traditional Western style of economic development.
Yeah, so, yeah. It's kind of similar to the 1930s with the Soviet Union.
Right. When yes, exactly. Were,
yeah. I say, well, you know, they didn't go through that crash.
Right.
And you know yeah. What's I don't know if I don't know the figures for sure. Maybe you can confirm. But I mean, in the region, the IDB is the major lender, the Inter-American
right.
Development
yeah.
Bank. Yeah. For development projects, right? Even yeah. more than the World Bank usually and stuff.
Yeah.
But and I remember looking at some figures a couple of years ago where, you know, China's loans have exceeded the IDB by
right.
far.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, so China by far is the largest investor in Latin America from those yeah. figures I've seen. I don't know if that needs to be qualified in any way. But I know the debate in a similar thing is in Africa, for example, and there's a whole debate about, you know,
yeah.
Chinese imperialism in Africa.
Right.
And
right.
in the Caribbean, we have that, you know, debate and discussion as well. In Latin America, is there such a debate?
I wouldn't say it's as open or overt as it is in Africa, but yeah. I think there is a debate because, and I think it comes back to those two different models of economic development. Certainly, most of Latin America are still wedded to the Western view of economic development because, of course, Latin America, you know, was developed along the lines of European and North American, you know, the economy and society, in society even up through the 20th century, and so. China has kind of come late to the game, you might say, but and it's not really clear. I think Latin Americans are still sorting out: is a Chinese investment just because they want more access to soybean exports?
You know, yeah.
Is it just based on sort of resources, or is it more kind of an ideological offensive? You know, is it
yeah.
in which are they really trying to expand their power? I can only think of one sort of specific example of a. I don't want to say it was a radar station, but I think it was some sort of telescope in either in Chile or Argentina in the border, you know, in a very desolate,
right.
not non-populated part of South America. There's a Chinese telescope, or at least built with Chinese money, with some Chinese influence over its management. Is that being used as a listening station? So, you know, so
right.
that's sort of one way that perhaps Latin Americans are becoming cognizant of China's interest in expanding its influence. But I think it's really too early to tell. You know, I mean, I think some Latin Americans might conclude, and probably majority, that, you know, China's interested because of soybeans, because it's such an important part of the Chinese diet.
Yeah.
And Latin America has a perfect, parts of Latin America, South America has a perfect, you know, climate for growing them, producing them. And already before the Chinese were interested, were already, you know, growing a lot of soya for edible oils.
Livestock. Yeah.
Yeah. Livestock. You're right. Exactly. So, once the Chinese sort of figure out how to get access to enough foodstuffs, maybe they're going to lose interest in Latin America, but maybe not. So that's the question. So
you brought up the Japanese a couple of times, and I know you end your book on the
right.
note that you get to the Japanese musician.
Yeah.
But, you know, one thing, this might be tangential, but I'll use the opportunity to ask you, you know, when Alberto Fujimori was president of Peru, that like totally shocked me. I mean,
right.
I didn't even
yeah.
know there was a Japanese
right.
Community in Peru,
yeah.
let alone
yeah.
they're so, I don't know, so integrated that,
right.
that, you know, he was president and it didn't seem like that
right.
big a deal.
Right.
It's like, yeah, and the Japanese aren't known to be, you know, like the Chinese are all over the place in
right,
Indonesia
right, yeah.
and in every, you know, you could go to any outpost in Africa even, and you'll see a Chinese restaurant somewhere.
Right.
The Japanese aren't like that.
Right, right. I think that, well, the Japanese populations in Latin America are concentrated in just a few countries, and Peru is one of them. And also, I think Peru is somewhat exceptional in the sense that the Japanese have been there for three generations or more. And Fujimori was a third generation Japanese Peruvian. But I think it's
important. What was the origin of that migration? Because that's, I guess, part of the globalization theme.
Good question. I mean, I'm guessing maybe fishing or maybe infrastructure building.
Okay.
In the dislocation of, you know, when Japan went through its Meiji Restoration in the late 19th century and industrialized, there was, you know, people who left at that time. But I'm not really sure of why they came in the first place. But I think perhaps in Latin America, I was living in Bolivia when he was president. And, you know, a number of the Latin American leaders, well, the Bolivian leader, Sanchez Lozada, he spoke Spanish with sort of an American accent because he lives in the United States for so long. And a number of Latin American countries have elites who are trained overseas or have lived overseas. Mm-hmm. And so they seem, yet they're accepted, you know, as legitimate, you know, nationalist leaders of their countries. So I think Fujimori actually was more nationalist than they, because he spoke with a Peruvian accent. He didn't speak with a gringo accent. And also he was just very good at sort of, you know, wearing the proper dress, and he knew the customs, and he knew the music. He had sort of immersed himself in Peruvian culture, I think, from a young age, just because, I mean, obviously he had political designs, but also I think just because he liked it. That's what was familiar to him.
I mean, third generation. I mean, it's like, you know, that was his culture.
Yeah. And also, interestingly, he sort of fit the role of the caudillo quite well. We talked about caudillism. Yeah. He was someone who came in democratically elected, but then performed or staged what the Peruvians call the autogolpe, the self-coup.
Yes.
He basically shut down Congress and ruled by decree because he said, well, there's a national crisis, mainly because of the Sendero Luminoso, which was a threat to many in the countryside. He used that as a way of consolidating and expanding his power. So, yet another example of the diversity, ethnic diversity of Latin America, like you say.
We're coming in close to the end of our interview. Yeah. But I want to ask, you know, we've touched on a lot of different themes, but if there's a main message that you'd like, you know, readers to get from your examination of Latin American nationalism and globalization, what would it be?
Well, I guess coming back to what I said before about how Latin American nationalism is very complex and interesting, it has a left-wing variant and a right-wing variant. Sometimes they fight with each other. Sometimes one is dominant, the other is submerged. So I think that's one thing that makes it especially interesting thing to study. But also, just picking up on the Japanese example at the end, if we're looking at sort of outside influences on Latin America, I think, and this probably happens around the world, but I mean, if you come in and you're very overt about trying to spread your influence, like the United States, especially during the Alliance for Progress years in the 1960s, but still today, you know, the Agency for International Development, USAID building in La Paz, Bolivia, is one of the largest buildings in that part of La Paz. And it's a dominant presence. AID is a dominant presence throughout the Andean region. It's a very openly perceived one. Whereas the Japanese, they built the entire garbage removal program for La Paz, Bolivia. Millions of dollars, right?
Right.
And they don't have a huge, you know, sort of visible presence. I mean,
that's right.
There's not even a picture of a Japanese flag on the garbage bins, right?
I mean,
but everybody knows it because, you know, the Andes in many parts of Latin America is a verbal culture. It's an oral culture. And so word spreads fast. And so I think that influence actually could be subtly more accepted and would not provoke a nationalist response, as opposed to when you have the United States or other countries coming in. Perhaps the Chinese are being fairly overt as well, at least in Africa, not so much in Latin America. That sort of overt sort of, you know, we as an outside power are here to try and improve you and change you and make you like us. That's going to create a nationalistic reaction. Whereas if outside powers are more subtle, it won't.
That's an important observation. Yeah.
And also the European Union is very good about subtly trying to help out Latin Americans. Like the health service in many parts of Bolivia is run by some Scandinavian countries. And everyone knows it, but if you don't see, except for a small European Union flag, you don't see the presence, you know, on the health clinics in Bolivia or other parts of South America. So. Yeah.
Good. And I know, I mean, this book was written in, well, published in 2017. So
since,
I mean, are you working on any other projects right now that you'd like our audience to know about?
Yeah, well, I've been really interested in the drug war, sort of coming out of the last point that I made, the way the United States and other countries as well, Brazil is part of the drug war as well, and other countries, has been a sort of overuse of force. You know, how can we suppress the production of the plants, which are the raw materials for the production of illegal narcotics. And that's created a sort of anti-American backlash and perhaps a nationalistic backlash. And so I guess I'm looking at nationalism again, but in this case as part of a sort of effort to, you know, suppress and control the drug trade, which ultimately results in spending lots and lots of resources and not really solving the problem, which I find to be an interesting sort of dynamic of you know, excessive use of force and expenditure of billions, maybe even trillions of dollars, and not that much to show for it. So perhaps not an uplifting story, but I think an interesting one.
an important one,
yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for this interview. It's been really informative and enjoyable. It's been a pleasure. Yes.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as well. And I very much admire the New Book Network for all that it's doing.
All right. Great. Well, once again, the book is Latin American Nationalism, Identity in a Globalizing World. And we've been speaking to the author, James Siekmeyer. Thanks also to you, our listeners. Make sure you sign up for our notifications so you don't miss any new interviews on this channel in future. I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.